Project Censored with Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning. Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. It's Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. It's Friday, December 2nd. Today's show, we look at occupying global empire. We speak with one of the founding members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Carl Dix, who will be in dialogue with Cornel West this evening at UC Berkeley, discussing what future for our youth. Steve Zeltzer joins us from Workweek Radio, and we round out the show today with Professor Anthony Hall about Occupy movements in Canada, the ongoing nuclear crisis with Fukushima, and big media complicity in support of the 1%. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's show, we look at Occupy and Global Empire. And we're going to begin today's program by speaking with one of the founding members of the Revolutionary Communist Party, who will be speaking with Cornel West this evening at UC Berkeley. And Carl Dix is here to talk with us about what's going to be going on this evening and what he's been doing. But first, Peter.
Well, I'd like to introduce Carl Dix. He's a longtime revolutionary, founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party in the United States. He was one of the Fort Lewis Six. Six GIs who refused orders to go to Vietnam in 1970. He served 2 years in Leavenworth for that stand. He's co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality. And he's, since 2009, he's been engaged in a series of dialogues with Cornel West on the theme, In the Age of Obama, What Future for Our Youth? Carl is currently leading mass resistance in New York against racially targeted incarceration, the new Jim Crow, and specifically targeting the NYPD's practice of stop and frisk, which we will be asking him about. And he's bringing forth a new generation of freedom fighters to resist extreme injustice as part of building a movement for revolution, which we will talk about as well. So Carl, tonight, the title, this dialogue with Cornel West, which will be at the Pauley Ballroom at UC Berkeley at 7 p.m., and that's free for people to come in. It's entitled, In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Misinformation, What Future for Our Youth? Tell us what that means.
Well, what it means is, and this is a dialogue that we began back in the summer of 2009, you know, just months after Obama had entered the White House, and we felt that there was a lot of passivity on the part of people who had been active around progressive causes and issues, and that a lot of that could be traced to people's high expectations of what was going to be accomplished by putting Obama in the White House. And Cornel and I had been on different sides of that question. Cornel had actively campaigned for Obama, did dozens of speaking engagements as a representative of the campaign. And I was putting forward Obama is campaigning to become the commander-in-chief of the U.S. global empire. And if you think the person who takes that position is going to do things in the interest of the masses of oppressed people here in this country or around the world, you're mistaken. So Cornel and I continued to talk after the election and the inauguration. And over dinner one night, we had a conversation where it seemed we had achieved much more unity around this. And after we had the conversation over dinner and, you know, Cornel says, why don't we have this in public? And we felt it should focus on the future for the youth because that is really a crucial question. The question is, what is the young generation going to do? Are they going to find a mission of standing up and fighting injustice? Or are they going to go with the program? And we wanted to contribute to the former, standing up, resisting, and questioning. And one thing about this dialogue, this is going to be the first one since the Occupy movement has developed and spread across the country. And Cornel and I even talked about, well, maybe we just put a handwritten In the Age of Obama and Occupy, because this is a real different situation. You do actually have a lot of this new generation standing up, resisting, and questioning. which is something that we're both delighted to see. And we want to stand with the youth doing that, but we also want to engage them in some discussion around some questions like, what are we up against? Where should we be aiming to go with this, and how could we get there? And that's what we're going to be dialoguing over tonight. Cornell and I haven't been able to sit down and talk very much since Occupy broke out. The only chance we had was when we were together October 21st up in Harlem, where we did our first civil disobedience action targeting the illegitimate, illegal, and unconstitutional stop and frisk policy of the New York Police Department. And we got arrested for that, so we were in jail for a little while.
Yeah, Carl Dix, could you talk to us more about that stop and frisk program?
Okay, and I'm going to speak a bit about that tonight, too. But stop and frisk is a policy under which the NYPD has authorized its officers to stop people for any reason, or frankly, for no reason at all, demand that they produce identification, that they reveal the contents of their pockets. Now, this might strike people as strange in a country where you're supposed to have the right against protection against unreasonable search and seizure, but that right's been revoked in New York City, especially for Black or Latino youth. The head of the NYPD trumpets this as an anti-crime policy, and the NYPD is stopping this year on average 1,900 people each and every day and frisking them. Five out of six of the people they stop are Black or Latino, and more than 90% of the people they stop are doing absolutely nothing wrong. They can't even find a reason for writing them a ticket for littering or jaywalking or anything like that. So what has happened is the NYPD has been empowered to target Black and Latino youth, to make it known to them that they have no security in their person, that a cop can stop you if you look him in the eye. He can stop you if you look away from him. He can stop you if you walk confidently toward him. He can stop you if you turn and walk the other way. And all of that is legitimate. And the police chief has even told Black elected officials that he wants every Black and Latino youth to be afraid when they go out of their house that they will be stopped and searched by the NYPD. I mean, this comes down to like South Africa. It brings up, because at my last civil disobedience thing, we did one in Queens, and they decided to run us through the system. So we're in the cell with a bunch of other people, and there were a number of people there who were in jail because when the cops stopped them, they did not have an ID.
So you're just talking on that. Last year, over 600,000 New Yorkers were stopped by police. 84% of those were Black or Latino.
Yes.
And for no reason, for no justification.
Yes, for any reason or no reason at all, this could be done. And this year, they've escalated it. They stopped more than 360,000 people in the first 6 months of the year. So they're on pace to go over 700,000 this year. And it really does reflect, but also escalates the criminalization of a whole generation of Black and Latino youth. And Cornell and I, because this campaign of civil disobedience against stop and frisk actually came out of a strategy session that he and I participated in, and he and I drafted up a call for this campaign of civil disobedience, we decided that this was an injustice that needed to be targeted. We saw it as the pipeline to the racially targeted mass incarceration that so many people are talking about. And we felt like there was a missing ingredient of determined mass resistance, you know, and that we wanted to help to bring that ingredient into the mix in this fight. A lot of people are doing very good exposure, like Michelle Alexander through her book, The New Jim Crow. People are doing other kinds of things, programs to educate people around this problem. We felt, just like in the 1960s, you know, back then a lot of people knew Jim Crow segregation was wrong, but what was needed was the Freedom Riders to get on the bus, put their lives on the line, and ride down south to raise this issue before the whole nation and the world. And we felt like similarly today, some people needed to put something on the line in order to put this issue before people. And that's what we're working on doing through this Stop and Frisk campaign. And we're aiming to stop this policy. This was not a symbolic thing to get some publicity. We're aiming to fight through to stop this policy and to continue on to go it and stop mass incarceration overall.
Well, this is a movement, Carl Dix. Yeah. You're talking about a social movement of resistance towards state repression and state oppression.
Exactly.
And this is
exactly
happening right out in the open. And again, historically, this should be lost on no one, but some of the tactics that have been taken up by the Occupy movements, particularly on the campuses around the United States, have been nonviolent resistance and the linking of human chains and so forth. And one of the UC chancellors claimed that that's not nonviolent resistance, attempting to justify the police brutality. We saw UC Berkeley. We saw more of that at UC Davis. What's your take on this? Is clearly a rollback, pretending to erase the history of. I mean, if that would be the case, we wouldn't have had any of the things that went on in the 60s that you referenced.
Well, one thing that we did around the Stop and Frisk effort is that Tuesday at Columbia University, the police chief in New York, Ray Kelly, was speaking at a class, and some people came into the class, including some Columbia students, and they gave him the 2011 Bull Connor Award, which we named after the sheriff in Birmingham, Alabama, who was known worldwide for viciously attacking protesters who were standing up for the right of black people to just have equality and civil and human rights. See, because what they're basically saying is you don't get to stand up and challenge our status quo. You know, because I watched that UC Davis video, and it's really chilling. But it's even more chilling to hear people say, which some of the authorities down at Davis were saying, well, maybe the police felt threatened. You know, there were people sitting down, arms locked. That's what the protesters were doing. And the cop comes along and very calmly sprays them with pepper spray. Then he shakes his can so that he can spray them some more. And see, the real fear was that people were beginning to refuse to go along with what they went along with before. They didn't think that these guys were going to get violent. They thought that here's a movement that's targeting a status quo that the people on top of society want to keep in effect, and the police were playing their role as enforcers for that status quo. That's the role that they play, whether they're vamping on Occupy protesters or whether they're patrolling through black and Latino neighborhoods like an occupying army. That's what their role comes down to in society. And we've been working to bring that out, including in New York around the Stop and Frisk. One of the first places we went was to Occupy Wall Street, and we had a lot of lively conversation before we did it, because some people were saying, those people down there, they're almost all white. They don't know anything about Stop and Frisk. The view that won out, which was the one that I was with as well, but it was also, I think, correct. Yes, you're right. They don't know, and we should go and tell them, because they're talking about what happens to the 99%, and Stop and Frisk happens to a part of the people on the bottom of society. That's part of the 99%, the overwhelming majority of people who are being abused by the system. They need to know about these injustices. And what we found with some work, including that one of the people down at Occupy was a black guy who had himself been stopped and frisked a number of times, and he was like, oh man, this is great, because I hate this economic inequality that Occupy's about, but I also hate the fact that I can't drive through my neighborhood and go to the store without being pulled over by the cops. And he welcomed seeing that brought together. And actually, at our three civil disobediences, one key part of the core that's come together around that has been people from Occupy.
Yeah, it's certain you're connecting the dots here, and that's certainly something that the corporate media, the mouthpiece of the 1%, has, you know, dutifully tried to prevent from happening is that connecting of the dots, the common oppressors and so forth. We're speaking with Carl Dix. Carl Dix will be in conversation with Cornel West this evening. In the age of Obama, police terror, incarceration, no jobs, miseducation, what future for our youth? That's what they'll be discussing this evening at UC Berkeley in the Pauley Ballroom. That's at 7 p.m. and it's free and open to the public. Peter?
Carl, well, the stop and frisk program in New York seems to be an initiation by the police department to really crack down. And what we've seen comparable to that are DUI license stops throughout the country funded by Homeland Security and the Department of Justice, where departments can get overtime to literally close a street and pull over anybody they want, checking for licenses, and the justification is drunk drivers. And find maybe one or two drunk drivers, but then take cars or, and you know, from 30 or 40 people who are driving undocumented. And so we've seen that kind of operation ongoing here in the Bay Area for several years now. And it seems parallel that the country is moving in that direction of suppressing our basic civil liberties, starting with people of color, starting with the justification of DUI, but moving forward in a way now spraying young white students at UC Davis. That video went viral. And I think what's very important that we pull these ideas together and really start to focus on what type of a society, what type of a structure in this country and globally allows for this kind of operation, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, and I think that is important, and that's something that we're going to get into in our dialogue tonight. I would add to what you're talking about the terrorism justification, because
yes,
that's a big one, you know, especially you go through New York City and, you know, you're seeing the National Guard in the subway, at the airport, and then you're hearing that the NYPD is infiltrating mosques and other places of worship, you know, and you're getting the sense that, you know, in addition to driving and walking while black, it's even down to worshiping while Arab or Muslim. All of this is being brought together, and people need to see that, no, this is not about terrorism. It is not about your safety. It is about the safety of the exploitative and oppressive relations in this society and around the world, and keeping that in effect. That's what's going on around this. And Cornel and I are going to get into that. He's going to get into it from his perspective. I'm going to get into it from my perspective of building a movement for revolution, which is what I think is needed to get rid of all of this mess. And we're going to mix it up, you know. And like I said, we haven't talked that much since Occupy, but I'm sure that's going to come into the conversation. I know it's coming in from my end, but I think it's also going to come in from Cornell's end, because he's been quite active around that.
Right. And Carl Dix, we're also you're talking about this militarization of the domestic police force to protect and serve, clearly protecting and serving the 1%, as we saw with the big bank donations to the police prior to the movement, and the potential influence that had. We've also seen, of course, the collaboration between federal and local authorities in the so-called war on terrorism through Department of Homeland Security. So we also know that there is some of this orchestrated effort from the top down to, and what you're talking about really is repression, instilling fear in the population, targeting specific people. When you talk then about, this implies that reform, so to speak, reform doesn't go far enough to really address this kind of issue that's building and maintaining the global empire. You use the term revolution, building a movement from the bottom up to address and really challenge this kind of repression. Can you talk to us a little more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, when I talk about revolution, I mean that what is going to be required to end all of this, and I see all of this coming together, you know, I think that what we're talking about is built into the very fabric of this capitalist imperialist society. And I'm going to walk through that tonight, particularly in relation to the oppression of black people. I'm also going to talk about what could be done in a revolutionary society to educate the youth. I'm going to get into things like that. But when I talk about revolution, I'm talking about the need to defeat and dismantle the repressive machinery of the state, to take from the capitalist ruling class, because it's not just an amorphous group of rich people. You know, people say, well, Michael Moore is part of the 1%. Well, if you're really talking strategically, no, he's not. He's not one of the people in power in this society. It's a different grouping of people, and they're actually a capitalist ruling class. They have a repressive state machinery that they put in motion to keep their wealth, privilege, and power in effect, and you have to actually defeat and dismantle that and put in its place new structures of power based upon the active involvement of the masses of people who made revolution that would operate in a totally different way, not to maintain exploitation and oppression, but to actually end all of that. And some of it could be done right away because you have a revolution. You could actually get rid of the ownership and control of multinational corporations that exploit people around the world. And then others you have to work at, you know, because there are differences between a lot of people that are differences among the people that you have to work at a different kind of way, you know, and we would be doing that through the educational system. We'd be doing that through the media. And I'm going to talk about a draft constitution for a future socialist republic in North America that the Revolutionary Communist Party has produced that takes the new understanding of communism that Bob Avakian, the leader of the party, has done and concretizes that into what a revolutionary society would look like. So I'm going to get into all of that tonight, and I really encourage people to come out because Cornell and I get into this, and you never know where it's going to end up. I mean, sometimes we're talking about religion. Other times we're talking about politics. We get into history, and each of us learns from talking with each other, and I'm sure the audience will get quite a bit out of it, too. So I really encourage people to come out.
Well, it seems, Carl, what the depression or the recession has taught us is that the central banks globally are all interconnected, that if the euro is going to collapse or there's in danger of that, that it's going to impact the stock market in New York, it's going to impact spending in our country. And Occupy people, I think, are starting to understand this, that our high unemployment rates, our 2 million people being thrown out of their homes annually, all of that is related to a transnational capitalist society that is literally part of this empire of the U.S. and NATO's military occupation of most of the world. And so recognizing that, this is very transnational. This isn't just fixing the problem in Oakland or fixing the problem in New York. You're talking revolution that is transforming this transnational class structure to make it more democratic and more bottom up in terms of and eliminating the armies of power, police, paramilitary police, and of course the military, and in some way substituting a people's security for, you know, that's indigenous and to who we are. So where does this go? I mean, does Occupy, is that the beginning of this process?
Well,
can we build those links?
Occupy is a big leap in this process. And then one thing that's going on now is that you see Occupy grasping the breadth of what it means to talk about the interest of the great majority of people. Because, you know, the past few days there's been a conference in Arizona between some right-wing fascists, fundamentally, that's what they come down to, and some other people about how to launch even more stringent attacks on immigrants in this country. And one thing that Occupy forces in Arizona have done is they've laid siege to that conference because they've seen, like, if we're going to be true to what we're talking about, then we have to address that. Like I was talking about in New York, people are linking in with the struggle around stop and frisk. So what's happening is there's been a big leap in resistance. People are standing up, but they're also questioning. And like you're saying, capitalism is being put on the table, not as, well, that's of course how society should be organized, but like, what does capitalism have to do with all these problems that we're talking about? That part of it needs to continue, but also the resistance needs to continue, and the links between these various struggles need to be further developed and deepened. And all of this is happening, and this is like a crucial point for the Occupy movement. We have to keep, I think people need to keep going on that, and we're going to try to contribute to that in our dialogue tonight, and I'm going to bring the question of a movement for revolution into this.
We've been talking with Carl Dix. He'll be in discussion tonight with Cornel West. In the age of Obama, police terror, incarceration, no jobs, miseducation, what future for our youth? That'll be the topic of the discussion. Carl Dix, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And if anyone wants to come out and see that this evening, that'll be at Pauley Ballroom, UC Berkeley, 7 p.m., free and open to the public. Up next, we'll be back with Professor Anthony Hall, author of Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. Stay with us.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Honesty without fear. The Whistleblowers Radio Hour on Tuesdays at 1 p.m.
After every scandal, we learned that there were citizens who tried to alert the public, but were silenced and retaliated against.
I did not grow up wanting to become a whistleblower, but it was my job and my moral obligation to demand that truth and justice be honored.
Hear from leading whistleblower lawyers about how you can protect yourself if you expose waste, fraud, or corruption.
This country would be a much better place when we all recognize the contributions that whistleblowers make to our society and protect them from retaliation.
Learn from prominent whistleblowers who've lived through it.
Support those who protect you.
Whistleblowers are key to holding government and corporations accountable. Empower yourself. Know your rights.
Tune in to hear me interview some of our nation's heroes.
Tune in to Honesty Without Fear, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aww.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives?
That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we want you to come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Join us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health call-in talk show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time.
We'll be talking about current health news, plus Vicki shares her entertaining 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour.
And if you miss our live Monday shows, they're archived on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and Dr. Saputo. That's DocTorSaputo.com.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Okay, you're listening to Project Censor Pacifica, our morning show here, Morning Mix, and with Mickey Huff, and I'm Peter Phillips. Our in studio today is Steve Zeltzer with Work Week Radio, who you just heard. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And he's going to help us talk and interview Anthony Hall, who's a professor of globalization studies. He's done books called Earth in Poverty, which sets 9/11 and 9/11 wars in the
Earth
context.
Into Property.
Earth into Property. And 9/11 and 9/11 wars in the context of 500 years of globalization. And the publication of the American Library Association called Earth into Property, a scholarly tour de force. The Independent UK called it one of the best books in 2010. And so you've been around the world working with groups to try to impeach George W. Bush for, or not impeach, but indict him for war crimes. And you've done other work, and you've recently been working on Fukushima and the impacts that have happened there. We just came off, Carl Dixon, I think you heard the interview, talking about to what extent is globalization being addressed by the Occupy movement and the impacts of capitalism on a global scale. And is that something we need to work harder on in terms of Occupy? And where do you think that's going, and how does Occupy play into it?
Well, of course, Occupy is a global movement. It is around the world. I think we could be doing much better in terms of setting up communications between the different sites and partnering with one another in different ways. I see Occupy as essentially an emergency measures response. We have authorities after 9/11 telling us we have to give up certain rights and such because of emergency measures. Well, it's as if the citizens of the world, the conscious, most conscientious constituency of citizens in the world, have decided simultaneously that we need to do emergency measures response to a leadership that is pointing us off the abyss on just about every front. The war machine is unbridled and uncontrolled. The war machine goes right into Wall Street. The Reagan-esque deregulation turned out to be a license for kleptocracy of executive branches of companies to steal from the shareholders. Environmentally, it's the oceans, the old growth forests. It's just Fukushima is a classic example of it. There is nobody home when it comes to taking responsibility for the terrible dilemmas of our time. So it's as if citizens have found one another, and we are mobilizing and organizing. And now it arises, well, where are these public spaces? We have all this rhetoric in our constitutions. Hopefully it's more than rhetoric. It's actual. We thought it was real, that there is a right of public assembly, free speech, but we find there is no place in our societies where there's any public space anymore. Somehow we're told it's all privatized. Somehow we're told that these great constitutional statements are trumped by little park bylaws, little municipal bylaws. And we see that really now the ruling class is invoking police powers. Ultimately, the police state nature of this sort of unaccountable and completely kleptocratic elite that's in charge is showing their true nature.
Steve Zeltzer, you're going to be you're one of the co-organizers of this conference that's at San Francisco State University. That's tomorrow, December 3rd. Begins at 10 a.m. in Burke Hall, room 28. Again, that's at San Francisco State University. Fukushima, the lessons of nuclear power and the media. So let's get specific for a moment. Anthony Hall just laid out a pretty broad interpretation of and analysis of what's going on. What do you hope to do at this conference tomorrow? And you just came back from Japan, as our listeners may recall.
Well, the whole issue of nuclear power, nuclear weapons, the whole industry, for-profit industry that's behind the development of nuclear industry, came out of the war, really. And in fact, Andrew Phillips, who's the manager here at KPFA, is going to be by video at the conference talking about how a New York Times reporter was being controlled by the military and said after the nuclear bomb was dropped on Japan, there was no radiation. And Wilford Burchett was there saying, I see radiation. I see people's hair falling off. So from the beginning to the end, Fukushima, as Anthony, Professor Hall has said, was organized in the United States. General Electric sent plants there and was involved in bringing for profit nuclear plants, the 54 nuclear plants to Japan. It's for profit, and they were told, the Japanese people were told, that it's safe. Don't worry about it, despite the fact that people were being being radiated, that cancers were going up for the workers, not just there, but here in this country. And there's a complete media cover-up. It doesn't happen, even though it's still radiating. Radiation, even though radioactive material is still going into the rivers there, they're saying wash the trees in the forest of Fukushima. Wash the trees. Well, where does that water go? Goes into the streams and then the water in the oceans.
It gives new meaning to can't see the forest for the trees, I guess. That's a terrible situation, and the censorship of it is a key issue. The Guardian was just reporting that there was a China syndrome event in the first reactor, and some of the terminology. I know we were speaking with Professor Anthony Hall earlier about some of the terms that are used, like partial meltdown, some of these kind of euphemisms and things for this. That's again all part of the PR spin in support of this kind of, I mean, these are just literally rapacious type policies put onto people.
And now there's a smear campaign being directed at Professor Christopher Busby, who is one of those, along with Professor Kaku and Helen Caldicott, who's been kind of guiding us through this unprecedented situation. The most, do you call it an accident, an industrial accident? In a way, it's predictable. Yes, it's an accident in a way, but it was entirely predictable. It's, you know, how was it that 54 nuclear plants are built on a fault line, on an earthquake zone in Japan and also in California? You know, the issues of what we're seeing in Japan are replicated here in California. This nuclear industry, of course, depends upon could these privatized nuclear companies like TEPCO, could they get insurance for these nuclear plants? No, insurance company would provide them with insurance. So we, the people, the taxpayers, are insuring and taking all the liability. And of course, this is systemic throughout our whole system, and we see it so clearly now. All these operations, public money is used to generate private profit, and then the public are left with all the liability of the millions of cancers and deformities, which will be with us forever, because that's the nature of radioactivity. It's not just this generation. It's our gene pools, which are being destroyed in Iraq. I mean, and the clear nature of the nuclear energy industry, you know, going back to the Atoms for Peace speech in 1953, which was spun in Japan to justify this, you know, the first holder of a license, a commercial license for television, was a rabid anti-communist, and the whole television industry in Japan and the other U.S. colonies after World War II were all tied in with this. The first thing that Matsutaro Shiriki, who was in jail as a Class A war criminal, and then given this TV license because he's a good anti-communist, is to run a campaign, a pro-nuclear energy campaign, and he became the first czar of nuclear energy. So it's a U.S. Deal from the beginning, middle, and end. General Electric builds Fat Boy, Little Man, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki, and then the issue is, well, how can we use this, how can we take it further? So let's do nuclear submarines. They design a prototype. Admiral Rickover comes up with a prototype. That prototype is in Fukushima, the GE Mark I prototype from, you know, antique nuclear technology from the 1950s is what's burning down. GE design, where is the liability of General Electric? Where, you know, General Electric stocks, they're probably saying, well, this is going to be good because there's going to be more money now, public money put into upgrading nuclear plants. No, you know, the climate change people, we have to talk on a much broader scale than the XL Keystone Pipeline or whatever, climate change. But to my way of thinking, the insanity of this nuclear energy industry is threatening and menacing us at a huge level. And the Monbions, the Suzuki, the Bill Gibbons, they've got to talk about nuclear as well as climate change.
And here in California, the listeners should be aware, and there's going to be a press conference at noon, that the California Public Utilities Commission, which is packed with executives and corporate representatives of the nuclear industry, they want a ratepayer subsidy to relicense and do seismic studies on Diablo Canyon Nuclear Plant, owned by PG&E, and on San Onofre, owned by Southern California Edison. Now, why should the ratepayers in California subsidize the relicensing of these dangerous nuclear plants? I mean, it really is insanity. I mean, should we pay for them? Should the ratepayer have to pay to keep these dangerous nuclear plants going? That's what they're asking and demanding. So there's going to be a press conference today at 12 noon at the California Public Utility Commission at Van Ness and McAllister Street in San Francisco, where Professor Hall, Dan Berman, who wrote a book called Who Owns the Sun? Why is it we can't have efficiency? Well, it may have to do with the fact that these companies want to sell more products. They want to sell more gas. They want to sell more oil. They want to sell more nuclear power. That is what they're about. It's really a system problem.
It seems to me that the transnational corporate class and the U.S. NATO military industrial media empire uses as a core nuclear power as kind of a post-World War II, we've got the bombs and nobody else could have them philosophy of maintaining control in the world. And that, of course, threatened certainly the Soviet Union and the Russians today, but also threatened the Chinese in a great way because they're seen as the economic competition to the West immediately. And then we find out from Al Jazeera News today that the Chinese have built 3,000 miles of underground tunnels to protect their nuclear weapons, and they may have many, many more than has been estimated. There's kind of this Cold War. That terminology came up recently, too. And so the justification becomes, oh, we're protecting you from terrorism. We're going to occupy the world, and our nukes are fine, but Iran can't have them. And if the North Koreans have one, we'd need to do something about that, take it away or starve them or however we address that. So how does that fit into globalization as a power structure? And can we dismantle this? Is this possible?
It's such a clear manifestation of the absolute insanity of our times. Those scientists who were working on the Manhattan Project and in the era after that, there was a lot of discussion, well, we'll do atomic weapons, nuclear weapons, because surely it will force humanity to realize this warring trajectory of history, this development of higher and higher levels of killing sophistication. We can't go on with that. After the Cold War, you know, there was a moment there where, there was a threat of global peace, and the military-industrial complex, the political economy, you know, that is at the heart of the political economy of the United States, was menaced and threatened, and along comes 9/11, right on time. I mean, Fukushima and that nuclear industry, the nuclear energy industry, which is, you know, comes right out of the nuclear bomb industry, and it continues to be the same industry, essentially, it demonstrates that our whole economy, our so-called civilian and consumer economy, it really is just spin-offs out of the development of weapons. And all our creativity and wealth and treasury is still given this priority of let's get more and more sophisticated to kill people big, kill people small, kill people smart, kill people targeted, be smart, you know, smart in our bonds. No, I mean, occupy. It is emergency measures against, you know, maniacs who are unbridled and in control of the system. And we, the citizens of the world, have no choice but to global general strike. Citizens of the world, unite. Workers of the world, students of the world, veterans of the world, organize. SOS, emergency.
Yeah, this certainly is the message that the corporate media can't seem to pick up somehow about the Occupy movement and their adamant propagandistic refusal to connect those dots that you put together pretty quickly. And again, you write about that in your book, Earth into Property, over the 500 years of globalization. We're speaking with Professor Anthony Hall and also Steve Zeltzer from Work Week Radio. They'll be at a conference tomorrow at San Francisco State University, Fukushima, The Lessons of Nuclear Power and the Media. That's tomorrow at San Francisco State University, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's at Burke Hall, room 28. Steve?
Well, I think that we, the people, have to educate ourselves. We can't rely on the San Francisco Chronicle and even the New York Times to say what's going on. They're not going to draw the dots. They're not going to draw the connections. Although sometimes they talk about these articles. It's all separated. It's all isolated. In other words, what do the Occupy people want? What are their demands? You know, we want specific demands, and then we can talk to them. Well, if a system is falling apart, which is what's happening with capitalism here and around the world. And people see that. It's not one demand. It's not one issue. It's a multiplicity of issues. The system is, it cannot survive. And it is showing to us that the only way that they can survive is by crushing voices, arresting people for peacefully picketing, macing students who are sitting down on the ground peacefully protesting. I mean, you know, it's interesting. There was a video of a taxi cab driver artist in England who was on the general strike. And he said, I'm striking for people in Africa, in the Horn of Africa, who are suffering because of the U.S. military and the British military. I'm striking for people all around the world. That it's not just about me, and it's not just about people in England or my family. It's about the world situation. This is a world movement, and we as Americans have to take responsibility that we have inflicted on the people of the world massive deprivation, and now another disaster of Fukushima on people who were bombed by nuclear weapons, and they have to go through this thing again where, you know, the entire country is covered by cesium. You know, it's a crime.
Imagine the depth of the crime to cover this up, to keep people from knowing what they need to do to protect their own health. I mean, should Tokyo be evacuated? Could we, you know, have we dealt with anything like that in history? The media, the cover-up on 9/11, you know, a big part of what I see is the emergency that we need to respond to is the lies and cover-up in the media, the smear and disinformation that is passed around as if this is informing the public. So the media have to understand that they are not really in a position just to stand on the sidelines and report this, that they are a big part of the 1% that is being targeted here.
They're definitely part of the empire, and we've been saying that for quite a while.
And the conference will be streamed that we're having, so people can go to the website and they can watch
really
it live.
Good. You're listening to Peter Phillips and Mickey Huff of Project Censored Pacifica, interviewing Anthony Hall and Steve Zeltzer, talking about what's going on in the world. And we're almost out of time right now. But certainly we have to look back and think that the occupied camps are being broken up following city rules about tents and health and safety kinds of things. But I think it's really, as this escalates, we're going to see the implementations of things like what we saw with the Animal Terrorism Act 5 years ago, where if you interfered with the sales at a store that had animal products, like a fur store or something like that, you were committing a terrorist act. So how far are we away from saying that encouraging people to move their money out of Bank of America is a terrorist act in some sense? That seems to be the escalation, the laws, and the stop and frisk procedures in New York City, where literally any person of color can be stopped any time, seems to be an escalation of that as well. So I think we're in for some serious consequences, and we're out of time. So, Mickey, why don't you wrap us up here?
Anthony Hall, thanks so much for joining us. If Steve Zeltzer, of course, thanks for joining us as well. Workweek Radio.
Thanks, gentlemen.
They're going to be at San Francisco State University tomorrow, 10 a.m., Burke Hall, room 28, if you want to see more about that program. Also, of course, Carl Dix, our guest this morning, will be in dialogue with Cornell West this evening. And again, we'll continue, of course, these dialogues of occupying the occupiers. Thanks for joining us on Project Censored Radio. We have one quick announcement.
I had Santa Rosa Occupy at Students' Day of Action tomorrow. Begins a rally at 11:30 at City Hall. Participants will march to the Exchange Bank, where they have stopped giving out the Doyle scholarships for the junior college, and there will be complaints about that. So all things happening everywhere.
Thanks so much again for joining us.